And we got the rest of the show that will be coming up from 5 to 6, looking at the legacy of colonialism, race, and relations in Hawaii. Our special guest co-host, Rick Cooper, in the house as we speak. And before you go anywhere, just remember this Out of the Box special is made possible by KKCR's sustaining members in partnership with the good folks at Emerald Isle Properties, Bill Fernandez, and Kilauea Bakery. And that's a big mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
All righty, we got a full house now. Got some visitors visiting and some familiar voices that you'll hear. Alana, let me hear you.
Aloha, everybody.
There we go. You might recognize that voice from our Tuesday Soapbox show.
Yes.
And Rick C., how's the mic?
I'm happy to be here, Jimmy.
There we
Thank
go,
Rick
C.,
me.
Another familiar voice, if you've been listening Out of the Box.
Oh.
Rick C. used to co-host this every now and then.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and have, if you will, a relationship with Kauai Community Radio, done some consulting and some training with our volunteers.
Happy
so
to support.
Welcome back. And we are going to be talking, as I mentioned, a little R&R in Paradise, race and relations in Hawaii, the exploring the... if you will, issues related to race and the impacts. It is the impacts of colonialism and white supremacy in the modern era. So, Rick, why don't you introduce who we're going to be listening to and a little bit about yourself for our listeners that don't know much about you.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. It's a pleasure to be here. I have some history in radio and talk show host. My love of KKCR goes back, I don't know, 15, 20 years or so. And yes, as you said, I've hosted here on Out of the Box a number of times. I am most interested today in helping to support, conversation about, racism in Hawaii. That's the shorthand of, what I think our goals are. Jimmy and I have been talking about this, and Alana and Dr. Kiahi have been kind enough to join us and offer their mana'o to this vital subject. And in my experience in Hawaii with the Mankind Project group, I've come to know a man that I respect highly, and that is Michael Bonahan. And right before we introduce him, I'm going to ask Alana to give us a little bit of history about KKCR, and then we'll bring Michael on for the hour, and we will discuss with him ways about communicating about this critical and somewhat dangerous subject to talk about. And our intention is, I think, for clarity, for respect, and that's what we intend to
certainly is on. A sensitive topic.
It is. There we go. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So KKCR started out something like
this. So KKCR's origins actually were rooted in activism. I don't know if you guys know this. I just found out from Marge Dente this weekend. She spoke at a rally in Honolulu. So basically it started in the 80s during the time when there was President Reagan's Star Wars defense program at PMRF. There was a large demonstration of local residents. Janet Planet, a reggae DJ on a local commercial station, encouraged residents to participate, and she actually ended up getting fired for her political activism, and she was so determined to start a radio station that couldn't be censored or controlled by advertising, and that was the beginning of KKCR. So there was also a principal resident, Sally O'Donnell, Butch K. Kahu and his Anuhola family, Roy Richardson, Julie and Coco Kanealii, Fred and Marge Dente, and many later organizers that included Richard Fernandez and Vic Diananda, The station was able to start broadcasting after 4 years of dedicated progress by Janet's team and a legal nonprofit organization. So shout out to all those founding members for all their work in getting the station off the ground. While all the documents and permits were finally secured with the help of a generous donation from Glenn Frey and the Eagles, the disastrous damage of Hurricane Iniki was discovered by the U.S. Emergency Management Agency. It became aware that the North Shore of Kauai had been cut off from any emergency contact. With that added stimulus in our favor, it was a go, and KKCR Kauai Community Radio became a reality on air in 1997. With the passion of many brave station managers, volunteer programmers, DJs, boards, committees, underwriters, fundraising musicians, and over 1,000 contributing members, KKCR has become the voice of Kauai, broadcasting 24/7, now 23 years strong.
Yay.
Yay, Kauai Community Radio.
It's nice. Very nice. So thank you, Alana. And, and that's just to position the show to indicate to the audience that this has always been a goal of the station. And while this is, as Jimmy says, a sensitive subject and one we will do our best to navigate for the best of the community, I assure you that this is one of the goals of KKCR from the get-go. Let's say hi to Dr. Kiahi.
Here we go. We'll put Dr.
Great.
K on.
Hold on. I don't have earphones, so I can't really hear you guys. But
you look fabulous
in
that bandana. So let's bring Michael Bonahan on. And Michael, are you with us here?
Aloha. It's Michael.
Great.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much. Now, I got to admit, among this long thread of emails that we've been exchanging the last few days, Your long list of credits has slipped into some black hole. Can you tell us a little bit? I know you've done a lot of this type of training, Mankind Project, Boys to Men. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've done? You're a pretty remarkable man.
Well, thank you, Rick. Yeah, I took the Mankind Project's New Warrior Training Adventure, which is like a remedial rite of passage, back in 2010. And right away, I was inspired to get involved in the leadership of the organization. And what's required to become a certified leader in the organization is something called a multicultural training. And I did my first one in 2012. And, you know, back then, I thought to myself, you know, I'm not a racist. I have pretty much passed for white in my entire life. I'm half European ancestry, half Arab ancestry. And I've lived in Hawaii since 1967. And so that first training I took in California on multiculturalism really woke me up and made me realize that, oh my goodness, I've got racism that actually lives in me, just because it was inculcated into my being because I was raised in the society that we've all been raised in the USA. I've been studying. I'm a student of multicultural and intercultural communication, and so I've been studying it and practicing it as much as I can. And in the past 8 years since I took that training, I've founded the Boys to Men Mentoring Network of Hawaii, which is a in-school group mentoring program that supports boys from diverse backgrounds, challenged backgrounds, not a lot of fathers or positive masculine role models in their lives. And I've also ended up becoming a certified co-leader in the Mankind Project, as well as a certified leader trainer. And so when I was speaking with Rick earlier in the week, and he was excited about this new topic and this new show, R&R, I thought, well, wow, I was concerned about the safety of the conversations. And so really appreciate you inviting me on so we could talk about, you know, how to have a safe conversation, and how to learn and grow, as opposed to getting sort of stuck in our old belief systems.
Well, that's a vital gift you're offering us. So our intention, I believe, for the hour is to talk about, really set the stage for what Jimmy, Alana, and I, Dr. Kiahi, I think we intend to participate in a number of these shows, and to take this to a variety of different topic areas. It's pretty broad, And today's show, we hope people will be taking notes, mental notes, written notes, tuning in on how we communicate. I did a workshop with you, Michael, probably about 5 weeks ago, something like that, and I was impressed with your ability to navigate these challenging waters. And I know yesterday when we all four talked with you, I was again impressed, and I think you have something to offer. So that today's show, ladies and gentlemen, is going to be more about communication. So, Michael, where do we plunge in on this? What's the first thing? You know, I'm gonna pull that back. I'm gonna say the first thing I think we want to do. I'm going to say, I'm a Caucasian. My ancestry comes from Europe. Alana?
Oh, hi. I am black, and my father's from the Caribbean, and my mother's from the Philippines, but I'm 6 feet tall with big hair, so pretty much black, but also Filipino, but people might not get that right away.
And Alana, how long have you been on Kauai?
I've been here for 3 years. I first came about 10 years ago, and I moved here 3 years ago to be with my grandma. So
mm-hmm. Your grandmother lives here?
Yeah.
Oh, right on. Have Ohana here. Yeah. And where was home before you came?
California, Los Angeles.
Down south?
West Coast.
I say down south because I'm from San Clara Valley
okay.
in Northern California.
Yeah.
And by way of identification, I am a proud Chicano.
Oh, nice.
From Santa Clara Valley. And my family... my dad's was the first of his family that was born in America, if you will, the United States. His relatives were born in America, but south of the border uh-huh. in Los Estados Unidos, Mexico.
Your
and,
grandparents?
My dad's parents. And then my mm-hmm. mom's folks are Tewa people, Pueblo Indian from New Mexico forever. Mm. And we don't really know much other than that. Mm. And Dr. Kiahi.
Aloha, Dr. Kiahi. Uh-huh. I am a Native Hawaiian. Person. My grandmother is pure Hawaiian. Well, she passed away, but and I also have additional Hawaiian on my mother's side. I'm also part Japanese, and I have a Japanese last name, Kuroiwa, and I have Polish as well. And from my great grandfather. And some Chinese as well, and some other Asian ethnicities, I believe. Thanks to, I guess, Ancestry.com, we're able to kind of see.
Oh, nice. You did one of those.
DNA. Yeah, right. my mom did that. We were all kind of shocked when all of my family members went wow. through. So there's some secrets in the family that are no longer secrets. So
wow.
That was exciting, actually, to kind of find that. But yeah. Mixed plate on my side.
Thanks for sharing.
And again, Michael, you said Arab and Caucasian?
Yeah, and mixed European ancestry.
Okay, great. So we talked about five levels of communication. Let's start there. Let's talk about what the five levels of communication are, and then take it off in the branch off into whatever feels appropriate for you, Michael.
Okay, thanks, Rick. There are five different levels of communication. The first is personal. That's my own individual thoughts, feelings, beliefs, attitudes, values. This is how I communicate with myself and my thinking and my way of being. The second level is interpersonal, and those are transactions between two people, both speech and actions. The third is group. So just the folks of us, let's say, that are on the radio show right now, we're a group, and we're communicating as individuals to a group. And so that's called group communication. The fourth level of communication is institutional. So those are laws, policies, procedures, known organizational practices, actions by high-ranking leaders of an institution that carry the effect of policy or law. And the fifth one is cultural. Cultural shared values, customs, myths, rituals, and the language of all the subgroups and institutions that exist within the culture. So those are the five different levels of communication. And the reason it's important to understand them and be well-versed in them when having a discussion about racism or any of the isms in a multicultural or intercultural setting is there are going to be some discussions where we're talking about trying to solve problems. For example, racism is a huge structural and institutional problems in the United States. and we can see it playing out on the streets today.
Yes.
And it's been something that's in place, been in place for 400 years. And so we're not going to be able to have a discussion about what's going on in the world if we start using our personal and interpersonal levels of communication. So not that we can't. It's just that we have to be very well aware of what lanes of communication that we're going to be in. An example would be if we're discussing cultural racism, institutional racism, or structural racism, and a person wants to offer an input that's based upon their own personal experiences or anecdotal stories or their own self-judgments, that's sort of jumping across two or three lanes to go over. And, you know, so basically what it does, it doesn't work. I mean, it's great to hear our own our personal experiences and get connected to each other in one-on-one and in groups. But when we have a big conversation about, you know, what's going on in the state of Hawaii, what's going on Kauai, and you know, what's going on across the nation, then we really need to be aware that we're going to be having the conversations in the communication lanes of institutional and cultural communication. So I know that seems like a lot to unpack, and, you know, if something pops up, I'll be happy to point it out. Only the idea of pointing something out is just to say, you know, hey, your opinions and your input are valued, and the question is, are they helping the conversation, or is it argumentative? Whenever I enter into a multicultural or intercultural discussion, I'm there to learn, whether I'm facilitating or participating. And so I'm here to be a part of the conversation and also to support communication that's healthy. So that's the first thing, is the five levels of communication, and I'd be happy to refer back to them throughout the show.
Thank you. That's excellent. Let's talk just for a moment about ouch and oops. I think that's it might be something that could come in, and as you've explained it, it sounds like a fairly unoffensive and non-dramatic way to make a point.
Yeah, you know, it's often because of the limitations of language and because the hot button issue of racism can create sensitivities. I often will misspeak, or I may hear something that someone says and not get the intent of their message, but instead their message lands on me in a negative way. And so the ouch and oops words are used in a process around intent versus impact. So if I intend to communicate with you something, but instead you find it offensive what I'm saying, then if my intent was to communicate some data, as opposed to judge or project something negative on you, then we've got an ouch or an oops. So if I heard someone say something that didn't sound right, so once I was in a training circle with a leader that said, okay, you know, we were straying off a topic, and he said, let's be careful, let's get back on the reservation. We've strayed off the reservation. And there was a Native American
oops.
Man in the room who said, ouch. That hurts when you say that, because it reminds him of the wound of the Native American homelands that were called reservations, and to this day I refer to that in many circles. And so the person who said it would say, oops. A person says, ouch, it hurts, and why, what the reason is, the impact. And the person who said it would say, oops, and say, oh, I apologize, my intent was this. And it's a way to learn, and the best way to learn is by making mistakes. So I don't want us to try to tread around lightly and be biting our tongues. The more mistakes I make, the more I learn about the things that are sort of hidden in me, my unconscious biases, and some of the ways that the culture has sort of trained me to be an active member in the structural racism.
Great. So tell us, I mean, for the people that I'm guessing some people listening, I know there's part of myself in my own mind, for those of us who have that part of them that says, this is just too complicated. Come on, man. Can't we just talk about it without all these rules and boundaries and stuff? You know, really, Michael, it's just too much. Dude, get over it. You know? Okay, so now, you know, I imagine those kind of things come up or said. What do you respond to that?
Well, you know, if the person's interested in having a constructive conversation, I'll just say, yeah, first of all, I'll hear them out. I mean, if someone says that, if we're in a group and having a conversation about any topic that is sensitive, the most important thing is that every person gets a chance to be heard and acknowledged. Whether I agree with a person's point of view or not, when the person says, this is way too much, too complicated, don't give me all these rules, I just want to have a talk, it's okay, but at least the guidelines are out there, at least a suggested form of communicating that can help to keep the conversation safe and productive are in place. So I rarely do I push back against anybody because it just feeds the energy. Anybody who is basically doesn't want to participate at that level, you know, just feeds the energy of it. And it's important that to understand that there are, in particular with white people, there is something called white fragility that exists. And I know the term sounds negative. It's basically what it is that, you know, white people have been unconsciously participating and benefiting from structural and institutional racism for so long that if you were to say, hey, you know, you're the one that has to change, you're the one that has to make this stop, it makes a person feel, almost feel like you're calling them a racist. You know, and also what it possibly can do is it makes the person shut down. Literally, racism is like, is thought of like murder. So that a person has to commit it for it to exist. Whereas racism is a system. It's a normalization. The structural racism is a normalization, a legitimization of an array of dynamics, you know, historical, cultural, institutional, and the interpersonal. And routinely, white people have produced a chronic system of adverse outcomes for people of color, not specifically individual white people. It's the system itself and the structure. And so that's the important thing. See, once again, I'm describing levels 4 and 5 of communication, but the person may be responding levels 1 or 2. So,
you're listening to Out of the Box. I'm Rick C., sitting in today with Jimmy Trujillo, Alana, and Dr. Kiahi. And our guest is Michael Bonahan, and we're talking about racism in Hawaii and many different offshoots of that vital subject. Just to let our listeners know, we do plan to open up the phone lines later in the show, maybe around 20 of or somewhere around there. And when we do, we will ask for concise questions for concise answers, so you'll have a maximum of 3 minutes to state what you want to say. I advise you, if you have something to say, boil it down to what is really important to you, because we do value community participation, especially around important topics like this. And again, this will not be the only show. We will have others that will be coming up. Alana, will you be doing something on Soapbox around this issue?
I've had a few shows on it, and then next week we're going to switch to Pride for a week, but of course I'll continue to talk about it, maybe dedicate the first hour of my show to Tweety Tweet, something like that. And definitely any caller is always welcome to call in and suggest if you still want to talk about it. You know, it's all developing as the news comes, but I think definitely the time is now to talk about it for everybody, so let's do it.
Great.
Thanks, Anna.
Excellent. So, Michael, when we were putting this together, we the four of us were brainstorming on different terms, and so I'm going to throw these out and see which one of them that you feel like you want to feed back to differentiate from another. Prejudice, bigotry, exploitation, bias, class, oppression, colonialism, racism, prejudice. Some of those terms are ones that I think are, to my layman's uneducated, informally educated mind, so they all kind of have generally similar roots. Do you want to break any of those down to help us understand how they relate to more specific areas of the problems that we might have and the result of a racist system?
Well, yeah. Well, you threw a lot out there, Rick. The things that I often hear get mixed up, and this is what happens when we jump from personal and interpersonal communication into institutional and cultural. So to define what racism is, you know, racism is a belief that a particular race, that race is a primary determinant of human traits. And race actually is a relatively recent, in the last, you know, several hundred years, it was developed by white people to essentially create different statuses, levels of status and rights in a society. But a belief that a race is the primary determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce inherent superiority of a particular race, is racism. Also politically speaking, it's a doctrine or a political program based on the assumption of racism, and it's designed to execute the principles of racism. Then you move into racial prejudice or discrimination, which is now like specific acts. And then prejudice is the other word that we often hear. And prejudice, you know, means a preconceived judgment or opinion, an mm-hmm. adverse opinion or leaning formed without just grounds or without having sufficient knowledge. And also means, you know, obviously the injury or damage resulting from some judgment or action of another in disregard of that person's rights. So those are like a kind of more clear definition between the two. In Hawaii, it's a very different conversation that we would be having as opposed to the national conversation. Right now we're focused on Black Lives Matters, a matter nationally. And it's because of, you know, the incredible, this staggering number of people, you know, Ahmaud Arbery, Rayshard Brooks, Michael Brown, Terrence Crutcher, Eric Garner. I mean, the list goes on and on. Tamir Rice, Trayvon mm-hmm. Martin. I mean, it's just
Breonna,
you know,
Taylor.
Breonna Taylor. Yeah, it's yes. just there's just
on
dozens
and on.
Black Americans that have suffered at the hands of police, and it's not individual police all to blame. The bad apples. While that may be a case ever so often, it's because of our policing system is part of the overall structure of institutional and cultural racism. So, but in Hawaii, you know, we only have a population of about 3% of our Hawaiian citizens are black, and we have a beautiful, diverse population of, you know, Filipino and Hawaiian, you know, Pacific Islanders. We have Samoan, Tongan, we have Chinese, Japanese, Haole, you know, a massive mixture. It's part of what makes Hawaii such a beautiful place.
Absolutely.
And so it's easy to sort of like not to think, you know, that, well, hold on, I'm a Haole in Hawaii, so I'm a minority, therefore I'm the person who is like a victim of racism. And that is not a very healthy way to look at it, because what we're looking at right now is we're looking at those who have been historically excluded, so groups, a person or groups that belong to groups of people that have been historically excluded, and then there are those who have been historically included. So it's really about who has the greater access to resources, status, and power. So, for example, even though maybe whites aren't the majority in Hawaii, they still have greater access to resources, status, and power than many Native Hawaiians, Filipinos. I'm talking about as groups. There are always, there are always personal or interpersonal examples that you could point out. But overall, statistically, it's about access to resources, status, and power. Mm.
And the, you know, the, remember when we were talking about this, that there isn't regarded as a prejudice against Haoles, it's a backlash. Can you get into that a little bit? Because I think that's one of the things that's really interesting. And as I said, you know, we talked yesterday, I when I started coming over here at 11 years old as a kid, and, you know, as a teenager, you know, I remember I got the effing Haole, you know, this kind of thing. And
right.
I thought, oh, no, you know, this, you know, what's that mean? And I've come to evolve to understand where that's coming from and to really appreciate where that's coming from. But I'd like you to, if you could talk about what is backlash versus prejudice or however.
Well, I think, let me just intervene, because I think when you brought that up, Rick, you were saying that you'd experienced racism, and Michael was sharing that and I'll let him finish, but that was the example of backlash.
I don't think I characterized it as racism, but I characterized it as my experience in Hawaii, which it was probably the only thing I knew would be as some type of ethnic derision. So
right. Yeah, we use the term backlash because that completely exists naturally. I mean, you know, an oppressed group, individuals are gonna lash out, and backlash is an emotional and or behavioral reaction by members of a historically excluded group that results from many years of oppression that's directed toward a member of a historically included group. So backlash is different from the original oppressive behavior. Because it is an individual or group action that doesn't carry the institutional or cultural power that exists in the that the person who has been historically included possesses and still has access to their privilege. So that's important to remember because, yeah, there's going to be people that are going to respond negatively, that are going to react and backlash. You know, and in many cases, it's completely understandable. However, we're not trying to provide this definition of backlash as an excuse for bad behavior. It's just, you know, to be aware that it exists. And in the overall cultural and institutional discussion of racism, it is not an example of racism.
Dr. Kiahi, I'd like you to chime in here.
Thanks. I actually wanted to comment to that. And again, we talked about this yesterday, and I just wanted to raise again the point that, you know, with backlash, I think there oftentimes isn't a lot of awareness that further harms the excluded group, which, you know, I think that just that awareness can sort of mitigate some of that backlash on both sides, really, you know, as far as the excluded group further harming because of whatever kind of reaction that they're having, you know, in the example of, you know, again, in Hawaii with the backlash coming towards whites, you know, that again will obviously tend to violate laws and be punished. And so, again, there's nothing really productive coming of that. So I think it's important to have awareness over that and then find solutions where we can sort of hit it from that point of view, knowing that. So now knowing that it's not a productive way of dealing with the problem, then where do we go from there?
Well, I mean, does it all need to be productive? I mean, it seems to me it's an emotional response in the base of that backlash, and that speaks to me. I understand that when someone when there's a backlash response to people who are not native to Hawaii. I think that reminds me of something, and I think I don't like it, but I think it's on a level that it communicates something. It's important.
I agree, and so I think the problem is that there's a consequence, though. It's like there shouldn't really be a consequence to someone expressing their emotions, and so if there's no avenue to healthily, you know, express your emotions without being reprimanded, you know, if there's not that avenue, then there's going to be this other avenue that, again, further harms and further excludes the population. And I think that's related indirectly or directly to the sort of disproportionate, you know, representation in prison system, for example, in Hawaii. And so
what kind of consequences are you talking about?
Going to jail for, you know, if a Hawaiian person feels insulted and they feel emotional and they feel that they want to strike and harm, you know,
act out.
Yeah, as a backlash, you know, and then they end up in jail over it. You know, it's like they might feel fully justified even as they tell the judge, you know, I meant it. I'm not sorry at all, you know, and then, you know, again, they get thrown in jail and have to, you know,
suffer for that.
Yeah. Basically.
Yeah. Dr. Kiahi makes a really good point. You know, we actually got to see what a national version of that looks like when the cumulative individual, you know, rioting, arson, vandalism. You know, while some of that was done by bad actors, some of it was what would be considered backlash, you know, outrage that is expressed. And so, you know, it does complicate. It confuses the matter. It complicates. People who may be sympathetic to the plight of those who suffer from racism may, you know, will say, wait a minute, you know, we got to have law and order here. Or those who are protesting peacefully could get lumped into those very few that are doing the violent acts. So, yeah, it does create a setback for the cause. And like also, there's a certain boiling point where people just don't pay attention unless something gets broken or burned sometimes. I'm not advocating that that's what should happen, but historically, social change has never come without some form of violence or massive, some sort of bloodshed or violence. And I'm not excusing what's happening across the nation now. I'm just saying that it's to be expected, and it is a grand scale of backlash.
Just to add one last thing, and so I think it's important to also look at the results. If backlash is being allowed within a society, does that, again, when I say productive, you know, for example, you know, back in England, you know, they would chop off the king's head or whatever, and that would actually lead to a change in the regime. So in that case, that I would call that a result that they sort of, that met their needs, you know. But if it's just a bunch of protests and then all the protesters go to jail, I don't know if that's the kind of result that those that are sympathetic to the cause are actually looking for, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you're emotional, a lot of times you're not even considering the results that you're looking for. You're just like, oh, anything but this, you know.
Right. Right. Important. Alana?
So it's important to organize. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And have
and
intention.
To be peaceful. And to be...
yeah.
Go ahead, Alana.
Oh, no, that's all. Go ahead. Michael, carry on. I just wanted to actually bring up, while it's on me, while you were talking about the ouch versus oops, there was a part that you were talking about yesterday that I thought was super important about intent versus impact, because you never know how something is going to be taken. So could you just, like, speak a little more about that, maybe?
Sure. Because of limitations of language, or let's say I'm in an emotional state during a conversation or an intense discussion, I may misspeak or not communicate clearly. So my intent will be to express a belief or a story or a feeling. Mm. And in the process of doing that, I use words or a tone that lands poorly on the person receiving my communication. And so my intent is to share and connect and bring you over to my point of view, but the impact may be I'm pushing you further away, causing harm or even triggering a person through the careless use of language or my behavior or emotions, and so that's, you know, that's the impact versus intent. And as facilitators and as active participants in these sort of discussions, it's important to what we call in the Mankind Project, and in a lot of circles you may have heard, is called something called holding space. Mm. And holding space for somebody who is different than you is like the ultimate form of learning. Holding space for somebody who has a different point of view, who has a different cultural view, who has a different race, different upbringing, a different background, and hearing their emotional connection and emotional plight is about one of the most connecting things a person can do. So what it is, it's like listening with an open heart, listening with discernment rather than judgment. Mm. Holding space for myself, you know, knowing that I'm safe and only I can make myself safe. Mm. So if a person of color is giving a white person feedback, and that feedback, it really is very risky for that person to do that. So if you're a white person and someone of color is giving you feedback about race, that's a massive sign of trust. And so to say this person trusts me enough to be able to share how they really feel on this, about this topic, and instead of worrying about what their what the impact is of their words, I focus on the intent. Mm. And try to hold space in that way. And Rick knows about holding space. He does it all the time in circles as well.
Thank you.
So, Jimmy, we're going to open up phone lines in a few minutes?
Not yet.
Not yet. All right. Give us the word when we're ready. Michael, can you talk a little bit about, there's a few things, white fragility And white privilege, those kind of things.
Sure. Yeah, those are trigger words for white people. So there's a great book that was just released by Robin DiAngelo called White Fragility. And it's a great, I recommend any white person or person of mixed race who's interested in helping other white people learn about themselves, learn about racism, and having a conversation about racism is to read this book, White Fragility. It's hard to keep in print. It's a super big bestseller, but you can download it both on Audible and get digital versions of it. Basically, what happens is that a person has to understand that when you're talking about racism, good or bad is irrelevant. Racism is a multi-layered system that's embedded into our culture. You know, to limit the concept of racism to thoughts, acts, incidents, and behaviors that are anecdotal, personal, or interpersonal is the basis of all white people's defensiveness when talking about racism. But if we can elevate the conversation to the institutional, cultural, and structural levels, and then come to agreement about that, then we can work down to what is ours to do, what is ours individually to do, whether it's to work on ourselves, about understanding what our privilege is. So remember, privilege is, there's unearned privilege, and then there's earned privilege. Unearned privilege means that you are born into a statistically greater access to resources, status, of power. And earned privilege is, you know, you worked your butt off to get somewhere. However, white people tend to not be aware of their privilege because it's always been there. It's not something that they achieved. And people of color feel, they can definitely feel the impact of that white, privilege. When it comes to fragility, it's really about, white fragility is the biggest window into how deeply seated racism is in the United States. When you see a white person immediately begin to feel like you've called them a murderer if there's a possibility that they're participating in a racist system. And that's the problem, that's the challenge. And so reading that book, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, gave me a lot of tools to be able to listen and to be in the uncomfortable position of supporting somebody as they learn something new.
Excellent. Want to talk a moment about colonial impacts, the impacts on Hawaii, the European settlers, invaders coming here. And Dr. Kiahi, would you have any thoughts on that you'd like to share?
About colonialism?
In general, about your country, your island, your kingdom being taken over.
I'm personally a big activist in the Hawaiian sovereignty movement. So
excellent.
That's,
you could talk about it all day.
Yeah, I mean, it's my favorite subject, you know, and so with that comes all the historical data, which is at this point widely circulated, you know, even though it's widely circulated. As far as the overthrow and the illegal actions and the United States involvement and Congress actually validating that, you know, it's all out there, but still a lot of people don't realize that. And further still, there's less awareness about the impact, you know, on the people of Hawaii and the natives and non-natives alike, and how that's really shifted our... just our path as a people.
What are those impacts?
Just changing our entire culture, you know, from being sort of an earth-based people that were very connected to the land, you know, from the beginning of, you know, before missionary contact, and their religion being sort of rewritten as well, and Christianity sort of replacing the Native Hawaiian religion, and at this point even heavy duty Hawaiian activists will be also heavy duty Christians. You know, the indoctrination has been so deep that you cannot it just can't be removed, you know, or even questioned. And along with those lines, you know, again, and I'm not going to go super off topic, but you know, I tend to look at the vernacular that we've adopted as a culture, and also as, you know, just as in the United States, you know, the vernacular. Again, one of the examples that was given in the beginning of the show about, you know, well, we're getting off the reservation, you know, that's, that can happen automatically, you know, but there's other ways that we sort of create stratification and hierarchy through religion that we don't realize when we say, oh, it's a higher power, you know. Why can't it be an equal power? You can't even question that, you know. It has to be a higher power. I mean, otherwise it doesn't count, you know. And if there's a higher power, there must be a lower power. And there must be a higher race and a lower race, you know. It's in the vernacular. Mm. So, you know, without going too deeply into that, I mean, I think it's something worth looking at.
And thank you for that.
Well, and for me, the impact is obviously the, if you will, genocide of the host culture.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, the
I think like 90% disintegration of... like 90% of the population got wiped out by disease, right? Or something like that.
Right. And it's been perpetuated through generations now.
Absolutely, it still is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you just, if you were to compare Hawaii as a nation, like you would compare India or New Zealand, and to see the arc of transformation in India and especially in New Zealand, and how colonialism was pushed out, and native cultures and indigenous peoples' wisdom was brought more into the forefront of how the institutions were run. That hasn't really happened in Hawaii. Hawaii is still, you know, is still the conquering nation is still occupying it, so to speak, from the point of view, if you were to compare Hawaii to New Zealand or to India. And so that wound still exists, and there are a tremendous number of Native Hawaiians who carry that wound and their access to status, resources, and power is diminished in the face of that.
Right. There was no Treaty of Waitangi for the Hawaiians. There was no Treaty of Annexation, and we're still here occupying. Do we want to take that call? Is that
sure, let's take a call at 3 minutes. Call, you're on the air. You have a maximum 3 minutes. Please state your point concisely.
Sure. Real quick, this is Adam calling. Hi, guys.
Hi, hello, Adam. I just want
to share a quick story with you that can help kind of set the framework for the conversation going forward, because it has to do with both race and communication and perception. You know, I like the anecdote about doing the DNA test, and there's lots and lots of stories about that, because most of us in Hawaii, either as individuals or families, are chop suey. Our DNA comes from all over the place. And us as a family, you know, we try to be culturally and societally Hawaiian. One of my daughters, however, happens to be blind, Nihi. And she's 18 now, so about eight or 10 years ago, she's probably 8 years old, we were having a conversation around the kitchen table, and it became, and talking about Hawaiian things, and all of a sudden it became apparent that she, like a lot of things, like she didn't know what a ceiling was, because we didn't really talk about that, and she couldn't see it. It became apparent that she didn't really get what was going on, and my wife said, Nihi, do you know that I'm not Hawaiian? And Nihi became very quiet for a long time and then said, oh, well, that's okay, Mama. We still love you. And I think this is really important, because by and large, race has to do with what we look like and how people treat us based upon what we look like. And I think it's, we could all take a lesson from Nihi, because Nihi's entire determination of you as a person is largely whether you speak what we call olu olu, if you are kind. If you use kind words, she loves you. And I think we could all take a lesson from Nihi and speak kindly to each other, and that would solve most of the problems, because if we couldn't see what each other looks like, we would all base upon determination of how we speak to each other.
Excellent. That's great.
Point.
Thank you so much for that.
Yeah,
appreciate
that's a
that.
Really good point.
Mahalo.
And, hang on, guys. Phone line is open, 826-7771. This is Out of the Box. I'm Rick Cease, sitting here with Jimmy Trujillo, Dr. Kiahi, and Alana. Our guest is Michael Bonahan of Mankind Project, and what's it? Wisdom Windfall? Is that your business? Michael?
Uh-oh, yeah,
can you not hear me?
I had muted you accidentally.
Oh, no worries. wanted to offer a caveat based upon the last caller's statement. And, of course, what his daughter said is absolutely true and beautiful. And it's important to remember that I've heard people say, hey, I don't see color, I just see people. I said that once before I did my multicultural training to a black friend of mine. I said, look, I don't see you as a black man, I just see you as a man. And he said to me, he goes, Michael, if you don't see me as a black man, then you don't see me.
Wow.
In other words, for me to just think that he has all the same access to resources, status, and power that I have, and for me to say I didn't see him as a black man denies his history, mm-hmm. his culture, and his ancestors' plight. So, and not to mention the daily struggles he faces as a black man living in a white supremacist nation. So, What yes. your caller said was beautiful and true when mm-hmm. it comes to personal and interpersonal connections and communication,
yes.
and it can also mean the other thing. So
yeah, it can also be considered a microaggression, is mm-hmm. what you would call that.
There you go.
I've actually was told that just like a few weeks ago. I don't see him as black, so that's wild that you, and it like super triggered me. It just brought upon me like every single racist experience I've ever experienced. Like how could you just, you know,
deny me?
Just because you think that mm-hmm. doesn't mean that the mm-hmm. rest of the world isn't mm-hmm. is less ignorant. So, people watch out when you say that to your black friends.
Well, and I think it's also speaks to privilege when you're able to just disregard race because it doesn't really matter to you. Uh-huh. But for people of color, it matters significantly. In some ways, it's mm-hmm. their identity. And for others, it comes and goes. But when it comes hard.
826-7771. We have time to get a couple of three-minute calls on the air or less than three. If you'd like to get in a comment here on Out of the Box. Again, we will be doing more of these shows on racism in Hawaii forthcoming. We'll have two-hour show next week here on Out of the Box. Michael, what else do you have to add?
I want to add something.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Dr. Kiyaki wants to go, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of circle back to the thing about equality, what I was saying, you know, about, you know, in our vernacular, like it's a higher power and rather than an equal power. I mean, no one ever says that, you know. And I think, based on what you were saying, that you actually have to acknowledge our differences, but not make it about a hierarchy, you know, saying, well, you're black, I'm white, and we're equal, you know. And something that I sort of practice myself, and when I speak to people that where I feel that there is a sense of inequality, not only do I say, hey, you know, I'm your equal, you know, I also say, and you're mine, you know, and that sort of closes the loop for some reason.
Nice.
It, when you do the both
nice.
Side, people, not only does it bring you up, but it brings them down to where you're at, you know. And mm-hmm. so I think with that sort of, I would call it a technology, you know, we can actually acknowledge our differences and not make it about better than, worse than, and, you know, notice it when we speak that in our vernacular, you know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I just want to jump in, guys. Just to let everybody know, tomorrow, June 19th, it's going to be a celebration for Juneteenth and also an opportunity for people to protest and still, you know, trying to demand change and be part of this awesome movement going on. So there's going to be Black Lives Matter Islandwide protest. It's going to be multiple locations this time from 4 to 5 p.m. tomorrow. So you can, so the confirmed locations so far are Kapaa Beach Park, the county building in Lihue, and also the Poipu Roundabout. Some awaiting confirmation are the Hofgard Park in Waimea, across from Ishihara Market, Hanalei in front of Hanalei Gourmet. I was thinking of Duke Kilauea gas station in front of the lawn right there. So it's basically, instead of being in one central location, everybody can do it in their own community, but these are just some example spots. Choose a visible location, carry signs, make your voices heard. And, it's all about wanting to support the movement of the U.S. declaring Juneteenth, a.k.a. Emancipation Day, a national holiday, the day that... Yeah, slavery was over.
And people can tune into KKCR tomorrow for more details before that 4 o'clock hour.
Yeah, or you can always go to Kauai. I think it's Kauai for BLM. They have an Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Kauai might be on
BLM.
That flyer.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah,
Michael,
at Kauai for
and
BLM.
And we do have a phone call.
Okay, great.
So
and then
we'll have to be real quick.
Okay. Yep. Okay, go ahead. Hi, you're on the air. You have a maximum 3 minutes.
What's
on your mind? Less than that. Go ahead.
Eyes. This is Marge Dente calling, one of the original founders of our great radio station with Butch Kekahu.
And speak up, Marge.
And this was the most important reason why we started this station, because their family and their friends and all of the people on Kauai. They realized that this was a serious problem, and this was going on long before we started our meetings to start the radio station. And here we are, and I just wanted to thank you all for this very inspiring program, and I look forward to the ones that are coming afterward. Thank you so much for your love and passion.
And thank you for helping to found this radio station, Marge. Thank you very much. Appreciate
that.
Thank you, Marge.
Michael, I have about a minute to wrap up. But what hasn't been said, or what do you want to leave us with?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, I just want to commend everyone on this show. You know, you, Rick, Jenny, Alana, Dr. Keahi, and your courage to bring this to the air and to do it in a good and healthy way, and to stop and ask how is it going to work and how do we communicate. And thank you for your hospitality and your courage. Just remember that multiculturalism and interculturalism are the way of the future, and
yes.
Multiculturalism is an ongoing process of learning to appreciate differences, which is based upon learning to appreciate your own culture as well as that of another. And it's grounded in the principles of equality, mutual respect, acceptance and understanding, and these days, a commitment to social justice.
Excellent.
So that's what I want to leave you with.
And Michael, if don't want to put you on the spot, but is there any reason for you to give people ways to contact you? Would you like that or not? It's up to you.
Oh, sure. Yeah, people can reach out to me through wisdomwindfall.com, which is my website, wisdomwindfall.com. And
Very
you can
good.
Reach me at michael@wisdomwindfall.com.
Thank you so much for your wisdom.
Really yes, appreciate your
so
contribution,
much.
Michael. We will be
Mahalo.
In touch. We'll have to leave it there. My co-host, thank you so much for the effort. We're going out with a little explanation of systemic racism explained.
And two hours next week
Thursday.
on racism
yes.
in Hawaii. Join us
this next. This is Jamal. Jamal is a boy who lives in a poor neighborhood. He has a friend named Kevin who lives in a wealthy neighborhood. All of Jamal's neighbors are African American, and all of Kevin's neighbors are white. Because Jamal's school district is mostly funded by property taxes, his school is not very well funded. His classrooms are overcrowded, his teachers are underpaid, and he doesn't have access to high-quality tutors or extracurricular activities. Kevin's school district is also funded by property taxes, so his school is very well funded. His classrooms are never crowded, his teachers are very well paid, and he has access to high-quality tutors and lots of extracurricular activities. Kevin and Jamal live only a few streets away from each other. So how come they're growing up in such different worlds with such different opportunities for success? The answer has to do with America's history of systemic racism. To understand it better, let's look at what life was like for Kevin and Jamal's grandparents. Decades after the Civil War, many government agencies started to draw maps dividing cities into sections that were either desirable or undesirable for investment. This practice was called redlining, and it usually blocked off entire black neighborhoods from access to private and public investment. Banks and insurance companies used these maps for decades to deny black people loans and other services based purely on race. Historically speaking, owning a home and getting a college education is the easiest way for an American family to build wealth. But when Jamal's grandparents wanted to buy a house, the banks refused because they lived in a neighborhood that was redlined. So Jamal's grandparents were not able to buy a home, and because colleges could prevent them from attending through legal segregation, their options for higher education were really scarce. Kevin's grandparents, on the other hand, got a low-interest loan to buy their first house and got accepted into a handful of top universities, which traditionally only accepted white students. This opened up a wealth of opportunities that they were able to pass on to their kids and grandkids. Even as late as the 1980s, an investigation into the Atlanta real estate market showed that banks were more willing to lend to low-income white families than to middle or upper-income African-American families. As a result, today, for every $100 of wealth held by a white family, black families have $5.04. A 2017 study confirms that redlining is still affecting home values in major cities like Chicago today. This explains how Kevin and Jamal inherited vastly different circumstances. Unfortunately, the story doesn't end there. A big part of systemic racism is implicit bias. These are prejudices in society that people are not aware that they have. Let's go back to Kevin and Jamal. Against all odds, Jamal manages to be the only student from his high school to get accepted into a great university, the same one that Kevin and his high school friends are attending. But after Kevin and Jamal both graduate, Jamal notices that his resume isn't drawing as much interest as Kevin's, even though they graduated from the same program with the exact same GPA. Unfortunately for Jamal, studies show that resumes with white-sounding names get twice as many callbacks as identical resumes with black-sounding names. Implicit bias is one of the reasons why the black unemployment rate is twice the rate of white unemployment, even among college graduates today. You can see evidence of systemic racism in every area of life. The disparities in family wealth, incarceration rates, political representation, and education are all examples of systemic racism. Unfortunately, the biggest challenge with systemic racism is that there's no single person or entity responsible for it, which makes it very hard to solve. So what can you do? The first thing you can do is work towards becoming more aware of your own implicit biases. What are some prejudices that you might hold that you're not aware of? Second, let's acknowledge that the consequences of slavery and Jim Crow laws are still affecting access to opportunity today. As a result, we should support systemic changes that create more equal opportunities for everyone. Increasing public school funding and making it independent from property taxes would be a great start so that poor and wealthy districts can receive equal access to resources. Systemic problems require systemic solutions. Luckily, we're all part of the system, which means that we all have a role to play in making it better. Peace.